On the evening of March 12, 2019, University of Southern California professor David Troyer spoke at the Country Bookshelf about his work and his latest book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present, published by Riverhead Books. He is a critically acclaimed writer, anthropologist, and journalist, and an Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present, traces the rich, resilient, and multidimensional story that Native Americans have been living over the past century, and adds new chapters to the story of American Indian creativity and resilience in our modern times. The massacre at Wounded Knee was indisputably a devastating low point, but seen clearly, it is only one of many challenges to which Indian people have risen tirelessly and with ingenuity since first contact. David Troyer is introduced by the Country Bookshelf's Jessica Hale.
We're so delighted to have you here tonight to welcome writer, journalist, anthropologist, fabulous author of The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. I feel like this book encompasses so many things, and it's easy to call it a counter-narrative. However, I feel like David will give us a lot more insight into The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. So, without further ado, David Troyer, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee.
Thanks for having me in Bozeman. I've never been here before. I'm really excited to be here now. And I was excited also when I was driving around today to know that it's a lot like Minnesota, where you can, you've got your hand on the steering wheel and you just do the little, you know, people know. Also happy to realize that you guys also don't plow your streets, which makes it interesting driving around. So, in a little rental car. So, thanks for that. Well, I figured what would be fun would be for me to just talk a little bit and share a little bit about how this came to be. And maybe if there's time to read, maybe a tiny bit, but spirit's willing, you'll just be able to read it on your own because you're buying the book or getting it from the library or like stealing from your friends or however you get your literature. And then there'll be time, I also hope, and mostly hope, for question and answer, because it's really the most fun. Because the fact of the matter is, most writers spend about 5 years by themselves, locked in a room in front of a computer, not talking to other human beings, and then we get lonely. And it's nice to have a moment, actually, when you're out in the world, and you get to see the people who might be reading the book, and you get to have a conversation with them. And it's usually really fun, and it's pleasant. And even the hard questions are fun to answer sometimes. You get some weird questions, I will say. You get some weird ones. So I'll talk a little bit about the writing of the book. I should confess that I never had any ambition to write nonfiction. This is my second nonfiction book, but before that first one, entitled Res Life, I had no ambition to write nonfiction. I was content to be a fiction writer. I was content to sit in my room and lie on the page, because that's what novel writing is. And I felt, sort of falsely, I felt inaccurately that just as John F. Kennedy said he wanted to be in the presidency because that's where the power is, I felt that I wanted to write novels because, at least in the writing world, in my mind, I thought that's where the power was. I thought that's where the big kids played. And I didn't write short fiction, I didn't write occasional essays, I didn't write book reviews, I didn't do anything except write novels, but a couple of things happened which changed my course and brought me eventually to this book here. One thing that happened was in 2005, there was a school shooting at Red Lake Reservation. I'm from Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota, and in Ojibwe Reservation. Red Lake is just north, just up the road, 30, 35 miles. It's really close to where I'm from. And I had worked in the school where the shooting took place. And my father had been a teacher in that school, and my mother had also worked for the school district. We had really close ties to the school, and my entire family had really close ties to the community. Lots of friends, lots of relatives who lived and worked in Red Lake. So this kid killed his grandfather and his grandfather's girlfriend. His grandfather was a tribal cop, and then he drove to his school and open fire. And in 2005, it was the second worst school shooting in American history, second only to Columbine at that time. And you have to understand, like, at a place like Red Lake, there are all these little villages on this pretty big reservation, and the village of Red Lake itself is the biggest village, and the biggest building on the reservation is that school. That's it. Everyone gathers there. It's the most visible building. It's the place where everyone gathers. It's the most cherished building on the reservation. So to have that school shooting happen there was awful in ways I don't even think I can explain. I was in New York when it happened, and my brother called me, and he gave me the news, and I started flipping channels, trying to get more information. I was flipping, you know, all the networks. And the more I flipped channels, the more agitated I got. My friend who I was staying with was looking at me like I was insane, because I think I must have been acting strangely. I was cursing at the television. My voice was rising. I was getting really, really worked up at the television, at the coverage, not just because this thing happened. And finally, he's like, dude, what's the deal? Like, what's the problem? And I was enraged by then. I said, they're not reporting the news. That's the problem. They're not reporting the news. He said, what are you talking about? I said, that's not the news. And I was pointing at the TV. That's not the news. Every broadcast was saying the same thing. And then subsequently, all the print media in the weeks that followed said the same thing. On a poor remote reservation, tragedy strikes again. And I was like, that's not the news, man. That's not the news. That's just the same old sad story about reservations that everyone's always telling, and I'm sick of it. I want to know what happened. I want to know why it happened. I want to know who this kid was. I want to know who was hurt. I want to know who's in the hospital. I want to know the information. That is just the same old sad story. I don't want to hear that. I want news. And in the days that followed, the print media was the same. And I had meetings with publishers about unrelated stuff that week. And I was griping to one of them. I said, you know, when Columbine happened, they didn't say on a largely Anglo, very Christian, pretty affluent suburb. They didn't say anything about class or religion or race. They actually just reported the news. As it turns out, wildly inaccurately. But I said, but when they're talking about reservations, they feel compelled. On a poor remote reservation, tragedy strikes again. Again, why? Like, as though reservations are, by their very nature, an ongoing tragedy. I was talking to this editor and I said, you know, getting hot again, my voice rising again. I'm like, that's not the story of reservations. That's not the story. That's not why we care about these places. It's not why I don't love where I'm from, because it's awful. I don't love it because of the suffering. There's real reasons why I love this place, and there are real interesting things about these places that they're not reporting. And he said, well, what's the story about reservations then? I said, I don't know, but it's not that. And then he confessed. He said, well, I've always wanted to publish a book about reservations and what they mean and why they exist and where they're going. I always wanted to do that. And then, and this next part is just, this is just career advice. Lie. Because he said, but what Native writers write nonfiction? Like, who works in that genre? I just said, I'm the only one. It's just me, man. You know, I'm the only one who works in nonfiction. It's sad. And he said, well, maybe you should do this. We should do this book. I said, well, I mean, if you insist, I might be able to see my way to doing it. And I thought, I swear to you, I thought it was going to be easy. The big boys write novels, nonfiction. I just have to go and talk to a few people. I just have to collect some information. I have to just kind of assemble it. It's not like real cooking. It's more like hot dish. You know? I can do that. So I spent a few years doing that, making hot dish. And I handed it in to my editor, and he spent about half a year doing nothing, and I didn't hear from him. It's a long time. They're contractually obligated to give you timely editorial feedback. I did not get it. And I'm wondering what's going on. And he finally he calls me and said, hey, I read it and I reread it and I also wanted people in-house, everyone in-house to read it. I'm like, great, I want the whole team on board. He's like, yeah, so we all read it and we all kind of feel the same way. We really feel like you need to start over. And I said, okay, so there's some good parts and some bad parts and I just need to go back and like maybe rework some of the trickier sections and some of the transitions probably. And he's just like, I don't remember him laughing ever. And he said, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, we wanted a book from you. This is not that book. And if you insist on it, we're going to cancel the contract. And we're going to have someone else write it. But he was right. He was right to do that. I did not know what I was doing. I did not know how to write nonfiction. And I did not know the story I wanted to tell. I knew the story I didn't want to tell. And I did not want to tell the same old sad story about reservations. I did not want to perpetuate the tragic telling of Native lives, but I didn't know what else I could do. I didn't know what the other story was. The other story is not a story of hope, by the way. Hope is just the other side of the tragic coin, and we've been paid in that currency too for a long time. Like, things suck, but look at so-and-so. You know, like, not into it. I didn't know what it was. And then, shortly after this rejection, my grandfather committed suicide. He shot himself in the head. And I rushed home. I was back in Leech Lake the day that he did it. And I'm sitting with my grandmother in her trailer. She moved out. She left him. The way we do it is she moved 100 yards away. Literally 100 yards away from him when she moved out. She's like, I'm so mad at you, Gene. And then she moved 100 yards away because where I'm from, there's no point in being mad at anyone unless you don't have some way to remind them every day about how mad you are at them. Otherwise, there's no point to anger. There's no point to it. You have to make sure they know. So she moved 100 yards away, so I went to her trailer where she was living, and he moved out from his house. And she asked me to do two things. She asked me if I would write a eulogy for him. And I said, okay. I'd never written a eulogy either, but I thought, well, you know, I can figure this out. It can't be that complicated. Right? Story of my life. This is easy. And she asked me also if I would go up to his house and clean up his bedroom where he did it. And she said, you know, your uncles, they can't look at that. And I didn't even stop to think about why she thought I could look at that. Mm-hmm. Why did she think I could look at that? What was left of my grandfather's brain, quite literally, on the floor. But I'm not going to turn down my grandma, so I said, okay, I'll do it. And so I spent the day, she meant cleaned up, not just wiped down. She meant anything with blood on it, taken out of the room, including the carpet. I had to rip up the carpet. She goes, if it's in the subfloor, you rip that up too, and you burn all of it. I don't want to see anything. I don't want anyone to see anything. I don't want anyone to know. I spent the day sort of cleaning up his blood, his brain, and being really angry, really upset. I was hurt. I was confused. I was angry. I was in shock, I think, to some degree. But I did it. I spent the day doing it, cleaned it all up, burned the stuff, went home, and I had to write a eulogy. And I'd never written a eulogy, and I was trying to think of what eulogies do. And I said, well, eulogies have to say something true about the deceased, even if it's slightly uncomfortable, because there's nothing worse than going to a funeral for someone you love and hearing them eulogized in terms that have no relevance to their lives. Uncle Jimmy was a nice man. He loved dogs and Jesus. You know, and you're thinking to yourself, Uncle Jimmy was an asshole. I mean, he was awful to his dog, for instance. But he was our asshole. We loved him. But you can't say he was nice. So you have to say something true. You have to. So we recognize the person who's laying there. And the other thing it occurred to me that eulogies do is you have to say something of some use to the living. Ultimately, that's who it's for. The dead don't need it. They're off. They're gone. They're doing their thing. You know, depending on your beliefs. It has to be useful. It has to be of some use to us, those of us who have to carry on somehow. And so I was thinking about that. I'm trying to think about that, and all I can see is all this blood. I close my eyes, all I can see is blood, and all I can see is what I was doing that day. And it would have been so easy to make that eulogy about that. To make the eulogy a container and an expression of my anger and my hurt and my disappointment. To sort of wallow in that, to bathe in it. It would have been really easy. It was right there. That was what I was feeling. But I thought, well, you know, that's not useful, really. That's not going to help us move on. That's not going to work. Like, I can't do it. I wanted to do it. I felt like it felt natural to do that. To talk about my grief. Just sit there in it. I'm like, but that's not going to help. And it's not even really true. I started to think. Like, he lived 83 years. He's a veteran of D-Day, Battle of the Bulge. He'd only spent 3 years away from the little village of Bina on the Leech Lake Reservation where my family's from. Only 3 years away. 80 years he spent in that village. And I thought, you know, like, he'd suffered a lot in his life. He really did. Lost children, lost a grandchild, suffered in the war. He shot himself in the end for reasons I don't understand. Still don't understand. And, I mean, but I thought, I started to think about it. I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, he spent 80 of his 83 years in this village. It was the only place in the world that mattered to him. The rest of the world could have disappeared, and he would have barely noticed. The village of Bina, 140 people. It's the only place he loved. And I thought, you know, he got to spend 80 of his 83 years in the only place he loved. That's actually not that bad. That's actually wonderful. That's actually good fortune. That's not deficit. That's kind of a surplus of good fortune, because I'm just going to guess that most of us in this room have not been that lucky, and we're not even as old as he was. And in those 80 years, aside, you know, his 83 years, aside from the 3 years he was killing Germans overseas, he saw the only people he loved. He didn't love a whole lot of people. He was kind of a jerk. You know, he was salty. He was sarcastic. He was mean when I was a kid. He was not a cuddly dude. But he spent 80 of his 83 years surrounded by the only people that mattered to him, and he got to see them every single day of his life, except when he was overseas. His parents, his siblings, his cousins, his children, his grandchildren, his neighbors. I mean, literally see them out the window in this tiny little village. Again, that doesn't sound like bad luck. That sounds like good fortune. Yes, there were hard things in his life. We have to acknowledge those things. But that wasn't the sum of his life. And it would be really cheap to sort of eulogize him in relation to the split second that that bullet spent in his head, when we have the weight of 83 other years against that. 83 years versus a fraction of a second? What weighs more? You know? So yes, we have to acknowledge the hard things in his life, but we have to acknowledge his good fortune. And I began to see him differently. I saw him as not living a life of deficit or of want, but a life, a complicated, painful at times life, but a life of surplus, of excess, of plenty. And so that's what I said in his eulogy. But then that's what unlocked this way into that book that I'd failed to write. Like, what if, instead of seeing reservations, what if the job of writing that book was the same job as writing a eulogy? I have to say something that's true of reservations, even if it's complicated, even if it's looking at things that are sometimes hard. And I have to write something that's useful to those of us who care about them. Like, what if the job's the same? And what if my conclusions are the same? Like, what if I could see reservations not as places where there's less of everything, but as places where there's more of everything? Maybe more poverty, but more hustle. Maybe more pain, but also more humor and creativity. Maybe more crime, but also more law. And certainly more law enforcement. Like, what if I saw them as places of surplus? That's a new narrative. That's a whole new shape to the story. With that in place, I was able to see this place that I was from that was just deeply a part of me in a radically different way. And I was able to write it. And so I wrote the book. They liked it. It got published. And so that was Res Life. And that was sort of my first attempt at nonfiction. And I thought I was done. It was so hard, actually. Way harder than writing novels, as it turned out. Much harder. But then I kind of got the itch. And I was like, well, okay. I was looking at reservations, but I need to look at our lives more generally, too. Not just reservation life, but native lives. Because I'm here to tell you, like, we go through life, like, dealing with all sorts of ways in which our lives and our presence, not to mention our past, are misapprehended, even by us, I might add. This is not a problem only of outsiders looking in. This is a problem that we have looking out and back at times too, we Native people. And the problem is much like this other book. The problem is that when we look at Native history generally, we tend to think of it as a tragedy. The tragic mode is the only narrative mode by which Native stories are told. A few exceptions, but not many. There are problems with that. Just as there would have been problems with seeing my grandfather in it, only in a sort of, in terms of loss and hardship and pain and violence. Much is missed. The fact that Native people have been actors in our own lives is often missed. If our past is only seen as tragic, if Native people are only seen as a once great people with a wonderful future behind them, which is kind of how we're seen, once great, no longer great, we miss a lot. We miss the ways in which, and if history is simply just a catalog of suffering, we miss the ways in which we have been actors in our own lives. Karl Marx famously said, or not so famously, because nobody reads this one, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. It's super boring. But he says something profound in the beginning, which is, he says, all men make history, they just don't always make it as they please. They don't always make it with tools of their choosing. But they make it nonetheless. And it's a profound observation. And it came in handy when I was thinking about the heartbeat. All people make history. Native people, we have been historical actors. We make history, certainly not always with tools of our choosing, certainly not always as we please, but we have been actors in our own lives. If we persist in the tragic narrative, we are actually perpetuating the myth of our own powerlessness, which is a profoundly powerful myth. So when we do that, we miss so much, right? And I really feel like the way we tell stories, the stories we tell shape the reality we inhabit. It shapes the possible seen, the possible imagined. Words shape the world in a fundamental way. And so if we persist in tragic tellings, if we persist in stories of our own powerlessness, we not only misapprehend the past, but we radically limit the future. And I really think it's that simple. But it's also, I think, really profound. And it's important to notice that. There's also this tendency, and this was also part of the thinking of this book, there's a tendency to think of Native history as a sideshow to American history. This is certainly taught that way, to the extent that it's taught at all. You only have to look at the tenses in which Native history is taught. It's always past tense. The Lakota lived on the plains, you know, and the many sort of tens of thousands of Lakota who are living on the plains are like, living? So when grade school teachers are like, well, it's the one thing I can do, I'm like, watch your tenses. It's a simple move, but like, don't use the past tense. Maybe try the present tense. Maybe try the imperfect tense. The Lakota are living. I mean, it's kind of fun. Changes things. But there's this tendency to think of Native history as a sideshow to American history. And there's a tendency only to tune into Native history and Native stories as a kind of liberal social act. It's like, well, damn it, you know, like, I know, like, I didn't do it. I mean, it wasn't me. Hashtag not all Americans. My ancestors, like, stole some land a little bit. So at least I could do is read this book. There is that flavor to people's interest. Bad things happened, always in the sort of, right, passively constructed. Mistakes were made. Bad things happened. Diseases spread. Slavery was a thing. Massacres unfolded, right? Always without an object, always without an agent. But the least I can do is just tune in a little bit, you know, and watch this little show about Pine Ridge and feel really, really hard feelings. And then unburden myself on the page, maybe cry a little bit, and then move on. That's the sort of temperature of a lot of people's interest. Either tepid or a quick, fast boil, quickly cooled. And the reason is because of the narrative. That's how tragedies work. That's how they're designed to work. Aristotle knew this all that time ago. Tragedies, he said, are narratives constructed in such a way as to create really intense action that result in the eruption of the twin feelings of pity and fear, which lead to an emotional catharsis and unburdening. That's how tragic stories work. That's how Hamlet works. That's how Macbeth works. That's how the story of Native America works. Always. But this is to misapprehend the way I think Native history actually works. Not as a sideshow. Not as a sort of moment for liberal catharsis. I really feel firmly that you can't understand American history unless you understand American Indian history. You can't. It's not a sideshow. It's fundamental. You can't. Not only will you not understand Native people if you don't know Native history, you won't understand America if you don't read Native history. America's first revolutionary act was to dump tea in Boston Harbor. We all know this. Not many of us know that it wasn't just the dumping of tea in Boston Harbor. It was also, they dressed up as Mohawk Indians with gestoa and face paint and buckskins and then dumped tea in Boston Harbor. From the very first moment, America's self-regard was colored and affected by its relationship with us. After that very successful revolution, when America was looking about to think for models for how to organize itself, who did it look to? The Iroquois Confederacy. Our division of powers, our sort of executive, legislative, judicial system, and the division between them was in part modeled on the organization of the Iroquois Confederacy in what's now upstate New York and sort of eastern Ontario. From the beginning, America has understood itself and made itself in relation to us. The first test of the young republic, the first big test, was not the Civil War. Right? The Civil War is often taught as the first test of states' rights versus federal power. That was not the first time that question was asked. The first time that question was asked was in relation to Georgia's desire to remove Indian tribes from the Southeast so it could mine gold and settle native lands in what's now Georgia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. The sovereign nations who lived there said, no, thank you. You have no power over us. Our agreements are with the United States government. And they took their case to court and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And Chief Justice John Marshall ruled three times in the favor of the five civilized tribes in the American Southeast. And he said, these states have no power or jurisdiction over Indian tribes in their areas. Indian tribes exist as sovereign nations in relation to the sovereign nation of the United States. Of course, Andrew Jackson, an incorrigible, greedy real estate speculator, not unlike our current president, said, well, that's their decision. Let's see him try to enforce it. And then removed Native people from the Southeast and moved them to Indian territories, what's now Oklahoma. Anyway, that was the first test of states' rights versus federal power. In the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the Supreme Court, so even more recently, the Supreme Court heard more cases about federal Indian law than any other genre of law. More than reproductive rights, more than immigration, more than banking. So America, bruised and conflicted after enduring civil rights, the Pentagon Papers, the Vietnam War, Watergate, was trying to understand itself anew, and in part, it understood itself anew in relation to tribal persistence and the recognition of the sovereign rights of Indian community. America has always practiced the experiment of being America in relation to Native people, and often, of course, during westward expansion and the full expression of manifest destiny, at our expense. So America has been shaped by us, and we've been shaped by it since the beginning. And so there's no way to understand us, and there's no way to understand America without considering us. And so that's, like, one of the things I was really trying to get at here. And all of this felt really important to me. So Dee Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which I'm riffing off in the title of this, it is the best-selling book about American Indian history ever published. 5 million copies in print. Never been out of print. 17 languages. It is the most successful and pervasive story about American Indian life. I happened to read it for the first time on the 100th anniversary of Wounded Knee. I read it in 1990. And on the very first page of that book, he devoted energy and enthusiasm and compassion to the telling of Native history. And for that, I'm really grateful. But on the first page of his book, he says, "This book is about the Plains Wars, and I start in 1850 and I end in 1890, the massacre at Wounded Knee, where, quote, the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed," end quote. On page 2, he says, "So if you happen to travel to a contemporary Indian reservation and notice the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor, perhaps by reading my book, you will understand why." And I'm a 20-year-old, lonely, weirdo kid from Leech Lake Reservation reading this far from home and thinking, like, not true. This is not true. This is not true. And it felt since then, and I did not have the tools until I wrote fiction, and then I wrote Res Life, and then I considered this, and I finally felt like I had the tools to speak back. Not just to Dee Brown, who I think was a really sweet guy, probably, but to that common misunderstanding. Natives were once great, they are great no more. Natives were once here, are here no more. To speak back, and I felt like there needed to be a counter-narrative and a follow-up and counter-narrative. I wanted to start when our lives were to have ended in 1890. I wanted to bring the story of American Indian lives up to the present with the opposite thesis in tow, that 1890 was not the end of anything. It was a low point. The lowest, maybe. Our populations were the lowest they had been in history. 200,000 Native people on the census in 1900, down from 20 million, something like that. 400 short years before. It was a low point, but a low point from which we have been emerging, we've been fighting, we've been struggling, and that we've been succeeding in moving away from, moving beyond. And it seemed to me poignant that we talk a lot about the dead who died at the massacre at Wounded Knee Creek, around 150 Lakota, mostly women and children. But we don't talk about the 200, the 250 who did not die, who survived, who lived on, who got married and got jobs and went to school, and some converted to Christianity and some did not. Some were assholes. It's important to remember, we're talking about human beings. Human beings are layered and complex. Some were not. Some were generous, some were greedy. They were all human. And they birthed a nation that exists still. You know, they carried it forward. The opposite of tragedy is not hope. The opposite of tragedy, to me, tragedy turns us into statistics and turns our lives into a condition. That's what tragedy does. The opposite of that, the opposite of tragedy is depth, complexity, nuance, texture, layers. In essence, the stuff that makes us human. That is the opposite of tragedy, and to me, that was the antidote to Wounded Knee and to these common misconceptions. And so in this book, I went back into the history. I had to read and I had to educate myself, and I went back into the written record, but I also had to go out and talk to people. If this was going to be a book about Native lives, I had to talk to people, interview them, spend time with them, learn from them. And if I was going to ask them to put themselves on the line and talk about deeply personal, emotional things, I had to put myself on the line too, and so I had to put myself in the game. I had to put myself in. It's not fair to ask other people to risk and not to incur the same risks. That's just not how I roll. That's just not fair. So as such, the book is a combination of history, reportage, and memoir, and that sort of determined the shape of the thing. So that's some background on the book. I'm sorry I didn't get to reading any of it. I get carried away. Apologize. But let's have a conversation, if you don't mind, if you have questions. I'd love to have a conversation with you. Yeah.
I have more than one question, but one question is, you know, you were an aspiring novelist, and clearly that taught you something about writing. And you struggled with the nonfiction, but then you had breakthroughs. Could you talk a little bit more about how writing fiction, if it helped you to write the nonfiction? How did that experience as a writer set you up or help you to write these books?
Well, I mean, by the time I wrote Res Life, I think it was three novels. I don't know. I think I was, if I could assess my fiction in a positive light, I guess. It's not typical for me. I'm more of a self-doubter. I'm pretty good with details, pretty good with flora and fauna. As a teacher, I'm a professor too. When I teach creative writing, I discovered when I started teaching creative writing that I'm really structurally minded. I think in terms of structure I see stories and novels in terms of structure, which is why, for instance, I'm not so into Jonathan Franzen. He's got pretty good ability with language. He's got really good psychological insight, which I'm incredibly jealous of. But he's a horrible architect. And his books fall apart, and he has to bring in tanks. Because he just doesn't know what to do. So I really love thinking structurally, and so that helps. I think that helped a lot. I think after writing novels, I have a sense of sort of story, and I maybe have a good sense of when to push in and when to pull back, because I think effective fiction and nonfiction is not just a matter of communicating and sharing, it's a matter of withholding. Like vouchsafing and withholding. There's a balance in fiction between the two things. And in nonfiction. I think that helped. It's something like, I think my father, who wanted to write, could never master. Everything he imagined, everything he felt was like the most. And it was constant. And it was always... So like, he didn't write books for you. He kind of wrote books at you. So... I think really effective writing is kind of balancing. You're withholding things. And then you're relating things. And so there's this attention you set up. I think I was good with that, too, maybe? Or just, like, I was familiar with that. Maybe okay character. So when I was interviewing people for Res Life, but also for this book, I could see them, maybe. There was one guy I was talking to in Montana, Blackfeet guy named Red Hall, who's in this book. I didn't know him when I started talking to him. I was introduced to him as somebody who might want to chit-chat. 83-year-old, fiddle-playing, ex-cowboy, kind of a ne'er-do-well for much of his life, you know, kind of a rascal. And we sat down to talk in, like, the back room of a convenience store in Browning. And he was skittish at first. He's like, well, what do you want to know? I'm pretty good after 1934. I'm not so good before 1934. Like, well, I don't know if we should even talk, you know? And then there's this kind of push and pull. Until he finally admitted, he's like, well, why do you want to talk to me? Like, I'm not an expert in anything. I was like, Red, you're an expert on what it was to be an Indian man growing up in the 40s and 50s, to find work, to get married, to try and survive in those years. You're an expert on what it was to be you at a time that I didn't exist. I was like, you are an expert. You're an expert in a number of things that I want to know about. And then he's like, oh. And then we were off. And we talked for like 3 days. He was amazing. I learned so much from him, you know. But maybe as a novelist, like, I could hear the shape of his life. I could see it, and maybe I could accept it, I guess, as a totality. It sounds kind of loose, and it's hard to... I don't know if I'm describing that well. But so maybe making characters helped me see the real ones that existed in ways I might not have otherwise. Maybe those things helped. I don't know. good question, though.
What was one of the things, or a couple of the things, as you were in the process of writing the book that you were surprised by, that you learned
like about? Every step, like, by the way.
Just what are some of the things that really made a huge
difference? Gosh, it's hard to pick. It's hard to pick. I mean, I spent years, like, out and about and across the country talking to people for this book, and I was surprised over and over again by people, by the things they said, by the things they felt, the things they'd done. But one of the things, like, just for example, I had gone to Tulalip, which is a reservation just north of Seattle, because I was supposed to write a story about tribal cannabis. The New York Times Sunday Magazine wanted me to write an article about tribal pot and tribes that are getting into the pot business, and they thought it was ironic that communities that suffer from high rates of drug abuse and drug addiction would go into the drug business, and they thought that was poignant and interesting. I'm like, okay, I'm ambitious. I wanted to write for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. I'm like, okay, I'll do it. I went up there, and I spent about a week up there and talking to all sorts of people, and then I called my editor. I'm like, dude, there's not a story about tribal cannabis. I mean, they're going to do it, but the whole state's going to do it. You're wondering if it's going to be like casinos, and it's not going to be like casinos because they're not going to have a monopoly because the whole state of Washington is going to be stoned in a year. You know? I was like, but there is a story there. In this day and age, when we've spent 8 years listening to Obama talk about the disappearing middle class, which is a really kind of cagey way of saying that there's more and more poor people, that doesn't sell quite as well, you know? Because we all have middle class aspirations. But it's true that in America, like, middle class is shrinking. The number of poor is growing. The number of the very rich is staying the same, but they're just getting richer. I said, but you want to see a place in America where there's a vibrant, healthy, growing, exuberantly productive middle class? Go to Tulalip. Go to a reservation, which is completely surprising. You know, and it's pretty easy to see why. They have a very wealthy casino, but other tribes do too, but they don't have a middle class. But with that casino, they have diversified. They have amazing free daycare up to kindergarten. Amazing daycare and then preschool and after school care. Free childcare, but state of the art, like brilliant childcare. They have free, accessible, easy, and amazing healthcare. They have affordable housing. It's not a mystery, but it's happening. And they have, each tribal member gets about $15,000 a year from the casino in a per capita payment. Not enough to really live on, but enough of a cushion that you're encouraged to risk trying things. Oh yeah, free education too, as well. Your college is paid for. So they're growing a whole class of college graduates. They're growing an entire sort of entrepreneurial class and a lawyer class. They're making stuff happen. And so in this community of maybe 5,000 people, there are over 400 successful small businesses. Smoked salmon shops and convenience stores and construction companies and gravel companies and fishermen. And because they can try it out, and they got a little bit of a safety net, a nice safety net. If it doesn't work out, they can try something else. Like, they have a great middle class. That was super surprising. That was, like, really cool. I'm like, what? This is nuts. And they have problems. And, like, it's shocking, right? But we need to remember all these other writers who deal with these issues, but they're like, well, yeah, you know, but drugs are still a problem. I'm like, and okay, fine. I'm like, are you saying that drugs aren't a problem among sort of Ivy League graduates living on the Upper East Side?
Where drugs not a problem.
Right? Are you telling me? And Michelle Alexander in The New Jim Crow points this out compellingly. All the policing is done in poor neighborhoods. The majority of sort of drug possession and dealing happens in rich neighborhoods. It happens in suburbs. It happens in the nice parts of town. It's by design that it works this way. They're just not going to get arrested for it. Matt Taibbi covers this also in Divide, which is an amazing book. Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. It's a great book. Really readable. So I'm like, yeah, of course there's still drug problems at Tulalip. Yes, of course they still have problems with teen suicide. Yes, they still have social problems. Yes, they have cultural problems. Naturally, they're not a place without problems. But it's an interesting place. It's a surprising place. So that was one thing. That's in here. That's a chapter later in the book. But New York Times ended up not publishing it. They're like, no, we're interested in pot. I'm like, losers. that's not even interesting. This is interesting. This is cool. You know? So, whatever. You have a question?
I wonder if you've been to the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian. And if you have been, what you thought about the stories that they told there.
I have to confess that I have not been to the Museum of the American Indian in D.C. for no reason other than the fact that, like, I'm a single parent and stuff in California. You know, so like, just haven't made it out there.
One of the things that struck me there was, first of all of the people who work in it and all of the guides are Native people.
That's pretty cool.
They've done a pretty good job of having a cafe that serves Native.
I know the head chef there. Freddie Bitsui, he's Navajo dude. It's really cool.
But the thing that really struck me is that for many Americans, that's going to be one place where they're going to hear stories about Native people. I just wondered what you thought of it.
Yeah, I haven't been, but I've heard great things, and I know some people who've worked on exhibits. The area of sort of museum studies is one area where there are a lot of really talented Native people and have been working for like maybe 10, 15, 20 years to really turn it around. Because you're right to point out that for the longest time, Native people really only experienced in museums. And I remember going to the Museum of Natural History in D.C. when I was a kid. And honest to God, the exhibit was ape, Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon. And they had like a diorama with like wax, like a wax ape, and a wax Neanderthal, and a wax Cro-Magnon. And then there was an Indian. And then there's a white guy. Oh, yeah. I saw that as a school child. Things have come a long way since then. And there are a lot of Native people working in that field, a lot of brilliant people. So I'm glad you went. I've yet to go.
Can I just make a comment? And that is, you could argue that it's actually Indians who have changed the direction of museums with NAGPRA, which was
right.
a major
exactly right.
and a world and a precedent
right.
for other institutions.
Yeah, the comment is that Native people sort of have really sort of forced museums to really think, and allied disciplines, preservation, archaeology, anthropology, physical anthropology, biological anthropology, by our efforts to pass and success at passing NAGPRA, the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, passed in 1990. It was huge. That was a really big deal. And after that passage of that, lots of sacred items have been coming back to Native communities, and it's a big deal culturally, spiritually, and emotionally for Native people to have our things to return to us. Like, yeah, that was big. Thanks for pointing that out.
I just took a peek at the book I did buy, so I can't wait to read it, about your framing of Indigenous Peoples Day. And I don't know if you've had a chance to learn about our own city as an Indigenous Peoples Day, which is...
Rather than Columbus Day? So awesome. Makes me want to come back here even more.
But I also want to say for two reasons, I would love your thinking around how that fits, or it is a strong example of the kind of thesis that you've maintained for this book, which I'm excited about. But also for our state legislature, if people are interested, tomorrow is a hearing at the Senate State Administration Committee on adopting a Montana Indigenous Peoples Day. And so if you can't go to Helena, it's HB 219. You can all look it up. But we might just become a whole state of Indigenous Peoples Day. But now I would love to ask you, if you didn't mind my promotion, what is your thinking about that type of symbolism, that type of
I think it's good. I think it's important.
And if so, why?
I don't live here. No one's going anywhere. And so to recognize sort of that rather than the kind of... I mean, let's face it, I don't think we should have many holidays for, like, rapist slave mongers. I just don't think it's healthy. I don't think that's a... I don't think it's a good deal. But I'm going to challenge Bozeman to go further and Montana to go further. That's a good start. But for instance, in Bemidji, which is the border town that I went to high school in, that I grew up in, that was kind of a whole racist town when I was a kid, and it's come a long way. One thing that's happening in Bemidji, and it means a lot, it feels really good, increasingly all the signage is bilingual, Ojibwe and English. And so you have like white shopkeepers who, when I was a kid, would like kick Indians out, greeting Native people, Ojibwe people, like, Ani, Buju, like they'll use a little bit of Ojibwe, and it's not much, but they use some. All the signage for the men's room and women's room and welcome and come in, even the police cars, which is kind of funny, you know, are bilingual. And it creates an entirely different attitude and feeling, not just among Native people, right? Now, in Bozeman, it's going to be a little, I don't know, sort of, because there are more than one tribe, that would be a conversation. Same with, like, places like Missoula, kind of more than one, and Flathead, Salish, you know, also Blackfeet, a little bit, kind of. You know, so, like, it's going to be a little more complicated, but it's worth pursuing. It's this way that sort of local businesses have just jumped into it in Bemidji, and feels good. It's a really cool thing. It's happening in other places in the country, but I think Bemidji's sort of leading it. One more question?
What are some of the books or authors that you've read, say, in the last year or two that have really struck you positively?
Like any kind of progress? Do they have to have been published in the last 2 years, or this, well, I read them in the last 2 years?
Just, you know, sort of fresh in your mind. That
oh, okay, yeah. Definitely John Irving. Mm-hmm. Not the new stuff. It's kind of weird. Mm-hmm. It's kind of dull. All of it's weird, but in a good way. But new
Walter
stuff like...
Irving.
Yeah. World According to Garp is amazing. Mm-hmm. Mohsen Mohammed, Exit West. It's an astounding book. Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. I just read that. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. I'm mm-hmm. super into that. It's a little more sort of... It's not really in my zone, but I got into it in ways I didn't expect. But An American Marriage. Terry Jones. Mm-hmm. Really good. I just reread Flaubert's A Simple Heart. So good. It's one of the best short stories ever written. It's amazing. Those are some. Good last question. Thank you all.
You have been listening to a talk by acclaimed writer, anthropologist, and journalist David Troyer, who is an Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. It was recorded on March 12, 2019 at the Country Bookshelf. David Troyer's latest book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present, is published by Riverhead Books. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman, by Joy LeClaire.